This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 28th of September 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to edition 273 of the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Robert Bound.
Coming up on the show, the South China Sea and the dispute over who gets to control it. It's said to be one of the most divisive issues in the world. We meet journalist and author Bill Hayton, who's covered the issue in all its complexities.
Then we talk about Africa, and for a change, not about the problems in the continent. We're discussing the booming commercial opportunities and improving conditions for both the people and the environment when we meet the author, Dea Olopade.
And then wrapping up today's show, we'll enjoy a glass or two straight from central London's first winery. They've just put their new bottles out on shop shelves.
All that, plus of course some new music as well, coming up on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Robert Bound.
Is it the weekend yet? Of course it is. There I go.
That was nice. We mixed up the top there because normally you lead. I'm like the. It's like in a ballroom dance. I normally get dragged around the floor. I led you today. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I feel if it was strictly come dancing, what would I be? Well, who would be the sort of tasty, sort of former soap star in a sort of rah-rah skirt? Maybe you, Andrew.
I was thinking more of Anne Widdecombe for you. Anyway.
What's his name? John Sargent?
Yes. Yeah. I like John Sargent, though.
Okay.
Now we're getting really esoteric and nobody outside of this building will understand it.
No one will understand what that means.
Okay.
Google it.
Let's come back. So, yes, it's been a long week. We've finished another issue.
Another issue. It feels like we're working on a weekly magazine sometimes, isn't it?
I know.
We've been doing a lot of stuff.
November's gone to print. I'm off to Istanbul this week.
Bye.
Because we're opening an office there.
I might go to Brighton this week.
What's that for?
The Brighton Photography Biennale.
Okay, that's nice.
Well, let's call it a biennial.
I'll call you from Istanbul. So we're going there because we're opening our bureau and also be doing, that's English, a book signing
there. What are you going to go and be doing?
We're going to be doing the book signing.
Yeah?
Yeah. We're doing it in Cornwall. And also in Istanbul.
Don't be doing the accents. And how? What have you? Because I was. You were in Tokyo last week signing some books. I was in Kuala Lumpur in Singapore signing some books. Have you got a technique down pat? Have you got a standard phrase? Oh, of course you've got a standard phrase. Shall I tell the listeners what it is?
No, because it'll spoil it
for the people in Istanbul.
Anyway, I brought you back a very little something from Tokyo.
Oh yeah,
quite little.
What is it?
Kenji Hall.
Here he is. He's up next with the news look ahead. Okay.
Oh, that was a bit
that
mean
was,
anyway.
That was, welcome, Kenji.
Thank you. The abuse has begun.
Do you know your inaugural news look ahead, your maiden
That's
voyage
right.
on the often wobbly seas and always wet seas of the news look ahead. What have you got?
But you're sitting on a table actually here this week, surrounded by tall people, aren't you?
I thought you were going to say I was sitting on some telephone books.
You with Stevie B. No, we gave you all the special seats with the little boosters on.
Yeah, I had to jack that up really high. My feet dangling.
No, Kenji is, of course, based in Tokyo normally, and you were a very good guide to the city last week, so thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
Thank
I don't
you
remember
much
a thing.
For that. You told me how to write an email in Japanese.
I did.
What's the phrase you have to say at the beginning of every email?
お世話になっております.
Which means, be nice to me, please. Literally every email.
Be nice to me, like the Todd Rundgren song.
That's the other one. よろしくお願いします. Yeah, they both kind of mean the same thing.
Be nice to me.
Be nice to me.
Please.
I love that.
Good.
What I like is the phrase, いらっしゃい, when you're leaving someone at home and they're going off to work.
いってらっしゃい.
いってらっしゃい.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
That means, hurry
please
back.
Come home.
Hurry back, darling.
Hurry back, darling.
Anyway. Well, where are we going first in our news look ahead, Kenji?
We're going to start off with Afghanistan. On September 29th, Monday, the inauguration of the new Afghan unity government is expected to take place. This is the unity government that's the result of last week's power-sharing deal between Ashraf Ghani, who will be Afghanistan's next president, and his election rival, Abdullah Abdullah. That deal ended 6 months of an impasse between the two main candidates after a runoff election in June that was seen as tainted by fraud.
I quite like having the same name twice. Abdullah Abdullah, that's quite good. Rob Rob, that'd be quite a good name. I don't mind you being called Rob Rob.
A bit like New York.
There was Boutros Boutros Ghali.
I'm a big fan of Boutros Boutros Ghali.
Yeah, double names.
Yeah, it's good.
Keep it simple when you're being named by your parents. Okay, we've got the first name. Oh, let's just give her another one. Say that's fine. It's quicker.
It's a bit like Edward Woodward or something.
Kenji Kenji. That's quite nice.
It's catchy.
Yeah.
Well, thanks. We've illuminated Afghan issues. Let's move on.
We're going to stick to double themes here. The next one is actually two items, both UK, starting on October 4th, Saturday. The UK Rock, Paper, Scissors Championship will take place at the Green Man Pub in London.
Which Green Man Pub, I wonder? There's one quite near here. There's two actually quite near here. There's the good one that we used to go to sometimes after doing the weekly in the old studio on Riding House Street.
For a cider?
For a cider, yeah, cider.
That's they had Bounds, right accent
they had Bounds
the
cider. Yeah. That's Andrew's cider accent. does it specify which Green Man Pub?
It doesn't, but there is the address on the website. Okay. So
that sounds brilliant. Are you any good at paper scissors?
I'm a pro.
Let's do it. Right. Okay,
So what are we going to do? I mean, nobody can see what we're throwing here.
I know, but
I'll be the adjudicator.
Okay.
Okay, so I've got a computer screen in front of me, so Kenji can't see my hands. One, two, three. You saw me do it. He's beaten my paper with a stone. He's beaten my stone with a paper.
Well, you're trying to hide your fist.
Do one more time, because this is basically not very good radio.
One, two, three.
You're doing it uselessly.
Your
hands
are... Yeah, he's sort of bobbing your head.
No, but it's fine. He had scissors.
I cut his paper.
Yeah, your paper.
It's a draw.
Good. It will end friendly that way.
I have the five tips to win here. Okay. Surprise your opponent, wear a fancy dress to confuse your opponent, wear sunglasses so he can't see your eyes, try reverse psychology, and scissors is statistically the least thrown. Therefore, paper is the safest.
I like that. That's good. And if in doubt, carry a rock in your rucksack just in case.
Exactly.
Okay, and what's the other UK event?
The other UK event was the Lawnmower Racing World Championships, which takes place in Coneyhurst, East Sussex.
Look at you coming all the way from Japan, making us look like a bunch of crazies.
Well, that's what you do usually. So this event aims to provide a forum for motorsports enthusiasts without the high costs associated with car racing.
That's pretty good. That's a good Sussex sport, that. Shame it's in East Sussex, but never mind. Still God's own county.
But I have, I have to name a few of the lawnmowers that are brought to the competition.
Oh, okay.
Ready?
Yeah.
Turfinator.
Very nice.
Geronimo.
What's that to do with? Geronimo.
Geronimo.
Geronimo. Okay.
Weedy Gonzalez.
Okay. I like that.
The Lawn Ranger. And my favorite, Sodzilla.
Oh. what about Blade Runner? That'd be good.
That'd be quite good.
Except they removed the blades.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you'd have a lot of missing feet, I think.
What about Sod You? That would have worked.
Sod You would be very good. What a brilliant event that is. I think we should cover both of these at length. Maybe we can make a Monocle film or two for Monocle.com.
Sounds good.
About that, because I think that's excellent. We don't know enough about stupid things on there.
No.
Look at Andrew. He's closing that right down. No, we don't. It's all serious things on there.
And so you're back off to Tokyo now?
I am, yes.
Good. Bye.
Wait, they can't be like that.
No. It was very nice of you to come on.
I like the fact that you jumped into Beach. I really like that. Tom Edwards has got a lot to live up to next week, I think. Now
you think so? I've got big shoes.
I think that was really, really good. I think it was really good because also you tapped into a sort of the British sensibility as if you've been living here all your life. I love that.
Oh, thanks.
Kenji,
the token American. Thank you.
Token American from Tokyo, talking about Sussex. Brilliant.
The dispute over the control of the South China Sea poses one of the most serious threats to peace in Asia and the Pacific. The rumbles have grown in pace with China's power and also the realisation that this swathe of water and rocky outposts is key to controlling the world's shipping. And of course, below its stormy waters also sits vast reserves of oil and gas.
It's no wonder then that a number of countries have been contributing to the dispute over the area. This is where the interests of not just China and its immediate neighbours, but also countries such as the US, Russia and India meet. Author and journalist Bill Hayton covers all these decades-long territorial disputes and their complex dimensions in his latest book, The South China Sea, The Struggle for Power in Asia. And Bill joins us now. Bill, welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much.
First of all, is this all about flag planting? And if so, is it minerals and fishing, or is it the future?
It's hard to sort of to summarise it, but it's all of those things mixed together. And I think what makes it tricky is that countries are now seeing their national identity bound up with what's going to happen in the sea. It's not so much that sort of individuals, you know, on the street are, you know, think this, you know, who controls this tiny reef is the most important thing in their lives, but states, the people who rule those countries, have come to believe that this water is rightfully theirs. For all the reasons you were talking about, because of the oil and the gas, because of fish and that sort of thing. In fact, actually, the story actually begins with guano, fossilised bird poo, because in the 1910s and 20s, that was a resource that
you've got to brush your teeth somehow.
You do, and you got to fertilise those paddy fields. So the first people to make a claim in the South China Sea were actually the British, strangely, because a British guano miner wanted to go and mine guano on one of these islands, and then the Japanese got interested, and then the Chinese got interested, and the Philippines got interested. It started with guano, and it's moved into oil and gas and fish, And what's really driving it is this belief among the Chinese, government people that the sea is rightfully theirs. And I try to show in the book that this is not some ancient belief, but it's one that emerged in the early 20th century.
Now, tell me, there's numerous overlapping claims. And when you look at any of the maps of which each country claims as its territory, whether it's the Philippines or Vietnam or China, you realize that there's trouble ahead, because none of them seem to kind of avoid stepping on each other's toes. Now, is that because in the past it really didn't kind of matter because these reefs and these islands were used for fishing and perhaps a little more? But now suddenly there is a little jurisdiction. Who in the end is going to be able to kind of unpick, who's claiming what and whether they're right to be doing so?
Well, in a way, that's the nub of the problem, because there are two kind of shades of international law. There's the law of the sea, which basically says that you claim areas of sea from the land. So if you can say this island is rightfully yours, then you get 12 nautical miles around it, which is yours to do with what you want, and then you get 200 nautical miles where you can extract the fish and the oil and that sort of thing. But then the Chinese are trying to say, well, no, historically, this was our waters, and our fishermen, used to sail the seas, and so therefore we want to use a different kind of international law and say the whole lot, or pretty much 80% of it, belongs to us. But of course, the other countries disagree with that. And so the weird thing is that if these little reefs and things were not there, then it would be fairly easy just to draw lines in the sea and say, right, everybody, 200 nautical mile zone. And just like the North Sea in Europe, we divide it up and we share the resources. But because there are these tiny specks, and in total, although there's something like 250 reefs and whatever, their total land area is like 6 square miles. I mean, it's tiny and pathetic. But because they exist, you can then claim ownership of them, and then you can claim ownership of the seas around it. Now, it is one of the most absurd things I discovered was I was trying to find out why China claims as its official southernmost territory a non-existent island. And it took me a long, long time to try and work this out. But basically, the official southernmost point of Chinese territory is a place called James Shoal, which is just 100 kilometres off the coast of Borneo. But there's nothing there. The land is actually 22 metres below sea level. And I was trying to work out why the Chinese had sort of picked this random spot as their southernmost territory. And I think it all comes back to a translation error. That in the 1930s, when there was a lot of nationalist agitation in China, the Chinese, the government wanted to assert its ownership over these islands, but it didn't have survey ships. So it simply took the British maps and translated the names from English into Chinese. So, for example, in the Paracel Islands in the north, there's an island called Money Island, which is actually named after a guy called Mr. Money, who used to work for the English East India Company. But the Chinese simply translated that as the Chinese word for money, and it's now become known as that in Chinese. And in this process, in James Shoal, they translated it or transliterated it as Zhengmu, which is simply the Chinese transliteration of James. But they didn't know what shoal meant, because in English, a shoal is just a shallow bit of sea. But they used the word, they translated it as sandbank in Chinese, as the word tan. And then they thought, oh, sandbank, okay, so that must be an island. And then they drew a line around it.
These are nine lines.
And this is the origin of the southern. This is how the nine-dash line came to go down all that way, simply because of a translation error. In 1947, they revised the maps and decided that it wasn't a sandbank, it was a reef. But by then, they'd kind of committed themselves to the line. And, and the mistake has endured for the last 60 years.
So really, the way to do it is to go in the dead of night and, you know, explode all these kind of tiny islands so there's nothing there to put a flag on.
But the problem is, even with sea level rise, I mean, I looked at that and I thought, you know, this might be something you could solve the problems. But unfortunately, the international law is not clear. And you could say, well, if it was an island in 1982 when, you know, the Law of the Sea Convention was signed, well, maybe it's still an island now and people are kind of... And the Chinese right now are building up these reefs into sort of proper islands. In international law, it means nothing because it says, the law is quite clear. It says, you know, if it's naturally underwater at high tide, it's not an island, but the Chinese are busy kind of building concrete ramparts, just as some of the other claimants have done.
And all of these...
Giving you some platform heels, right?
Exactly,
All of these nations are up to the same game in a way. You know, they're sending out their fishermen, they're planting their flag, they're marooning poor little people on these reefs, trying to claim them. Like you describe a terrible kind of incident where the Vietnamese tried to claim a whole kind of series of reefs and lost ships and all sorts of things in the dead of night.
Yeah, so that was in 1988, which was the last sort of... There have been two shooting battles in the last sort of half century or so, one in 74 in the Paracels and one in 1988 in the Spratly Islands, both between China and Vietnam. The Vietnamese thought they were sitting pretty in sort of 1987-88, and they were occupying quite a few of these reefs and islands. And then they realised the Chinese now had the ships and the technology to get down there. And the Chinese were very well organised, and they sort of started sort of grabbing these reefs. And the Vietnamese tried to stop them. And it started off with literally a punch-up on one of these reefs, and it ended up with about 60 or 70 Vietnamese being machine-gunned, literally as they sort of, you know, stood knee-deep as the tide rose over their bodies. And amazingly, the Chinese actually filmed this turkey shoot, is what it turned out to be, and it's on YouTube. You can go and see. They released a movie of what happened for the anniversary of the Chinese Navy, and it's on YouTube. You can actually see, you know, the end of this rather horrible battle.
And what about the timing, Bill? I mean, is this naturally dovetail with the rise of China, or is it to do with more depletion of the stocks in the area and everyone trying to sort of get their hands on what's still left?
I suppose there's a couple of things which prompted it. I mean, in 1982, a new law of the sea was agreed for the world, which, although the United States hasn't ratified it, is generally agreed to be, you know, the way that we should look after the sea. And that basically created this sort of regime that, you know, 12 nautical miles is your territory, and then after that, although it's not your territory, you have the rights over the oil and gas. So then people started to think about, okay, well, we need to start claiming the territory so that we can draw these lines from it. And obviously people had known there was oil and gas off the coast of Borneo and that sort of thing. And then it was found near Vietnam. And so people became more, you know, commercially minded about what was out there. But then really what kicks it off is 2009. Again, it's related to this law of the sea, because in May 2009, that was a deadline for the countries to claim their extended continental shelves, what they said, you know, rightfully belonged to them. And that was the moment that China, for the first time, added a map with this 9-dash line encompassing almost all of the South China Sea.
It's on Chinese passports. It's exactly. Something to be proud of, isn't it?
And it's not, and no one really knows why the Chinese did that, because they never made it clear. They never said this, you know, we own this. And some officials have sort of suggested, well, actually, it's just supposed to indicate that the islands within this area that we own. But then if you look at, for example, what the Chinese oil company has done in terms of sort of trying to allocate blocks for exploration, they're not bothered about the islands. They're basically saying, no, we want this bit of sea, this bit of sea, this bit of sea. So different parts of the Chinese government and state are sort of saying different things about what this line means. But in May 2009, China attached this map to submission to the UN. And then that was really when it all kicked off. That was when the other countries started to say, no, and then putting their own claims in. And then in 2011, we had a series of incidents when Chinese ships were cutting the cables of oil survey vessels, literally kind of, you know, as they were going along, they were coming up and interrupting and harassing them. And that was the moment at which I sort of started to take more of an interest and started writing the book. But it's clear that there are some parts of the Chinese government that really do think, you know, historically they own the sea and everybody else is wrong. And I think that's really the core of the dispute.
And how easy is it for you to to be a journalist in that region? How easy is it to go to these little islets and inlets and islands and bits and bobs?
It's almost impossible.
Yeah.
I tried. First of all, I'm actually banned from Vietnam because I used to be the reporter in Vietnam, and they eventually got fed up with me and won't give me a visa anymore. Especially after I wrote a book on Vietnam a few years ago.
Yeah.
I'm hoping they'll let me in sometime in the future. I tried with the Philippines, and they were being very cagey. And then I realized that the reason they were being so cagey was simply because they didn't have a functioning airplane that could fly me there. And so when we talk about this arms race that's going on, sort of the Philippines are kind of limping along with some secondhand ships and planes. If you want to go, you can get on a sort of Philippines fishing boat, but it will take, it could take you 3 weeks to kind of sail out to these islands. Yeah. and around and back again. The Chinese, of course, and the Vietnamese not letting anybody anywhere near.
But it's a story that is kind of monitored. I mean, that's the interesting thing, that it's a difficult story to sort of monitor on the ground or on the waves, as it were. What can I ask you, one very simple question as well? Is it called the South China Sea by everyone else? Because if so, then presumably the Chinese have got the upper hand.
Well, the thing is, the Chinese simply call it the Nanhai, the South Sea.
Right.
They don't have the word China in there at all. It was actually the Portuguese that called it the South China Sea, because they were the first Europeans to get there. And for them, it was simply the sea on the way to China.
Yeah.
And then they when they sort of got as far as Japan, they realised this is a slightly different sea. So we'll call that one the East China Sea. Yeah. And then we'll have the South China Sea as well. But the Vietnamese...
It's a bit like what the French call French onion soup, isn't it? You kind of... It's like, well, of course they don't call it that.
It's just onion soup. Yeah. Yes, it's ours. Yeah. I don't think people have got very emotive about this.
Yeah.
I mean, the Vietnamese have called it the East Sea. Well, that's obviously geographically, it is east of them. And then the Philippines decided they had to have their own name, so they call it the West Philippine Sea. They decided a couple of years ago they would call it their own name, but it's all a bit silly. It doesn't mean anything else.
Well, the book is The South China Seas, The Struggle for Power in Asia. And the author is Bill Hayton. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you.
Let's have, Andrew, some music.
What kind of music shall we have, Robert?
We're going to have some music from the Classic American Songbook. An album came out last week. Very good album. Tony Bennett and Lady Gaga.
I saw Tony Bennett. Down the pub. No, I don't. No, no,
come
no.
on.
No, I saw Tony Bennett in concert.
Did you?
2 years ago.
Oh, I love Tony Bennett. He's a good old boy. Is Antonio Benedetti? Is he not? And this album with Lady Gaga is. People have gone, what's the point in that existing? Until you listen to it, you will not realise why. It's really good, and it's quite nice to listen to Lady Gaga, especially not being an art project and being all clever and pretending la la la. She's just a very good. She's actually a very good singer. From it, it's called Cheek to Cheek, the record. My favourite way to stand on a diving board with anyone. and this is the title track. Yeah, this is Cheek to Cheek. It's Tony Bennett and Lady Gaga.
So you met someone, set you back on your heels. Goody, goody. So you met someone and now you know how it feels. Goody, goody. So you gave him your heart too, just as I gave mine to you.
Stop talking about this stuff.
And he broke it in little pieces. Now how do you do?
That's really
so you
song.
Lie awake, singing the blues all night. Goody, goody. So you think that love's a barrel of dynamite.
I told you I'm no goody, I'm a baddie.
Hooray and hallelujah. You had it coming to you.
I think you're funny,
goody,
huh?
Goody for him. Goody, goody for me.
Goody, goody for you.
And I hope you're satisfied, you rascal.
That's
you.
Real cheeky, Tony.
Someone who set you back on your heels.
So what?
Goody, goody. So you met someone and now you know how it feels.
I was confused,
goody, goody.
You know?
So you gave him your heart too, just as I gave mine to you. And he broke it in little pieces.
I know.
Now how do you do? So you lie awake just singing the blues all night.
Yeah, all night. All
goody,
night
goody.
Long.
So you think that love's a barrel of dynamite.
Yeah, so what sometimes?
Hooray and hallelujah, you had it coming to
stop
you.
Stop laughing.
Goody, goody for him. Goody, goody for me.
I'm not a goody, I'm a bad.
Your
baddie.
Love has been denied. You've been taken for a ride.
What are you happy
and
now?
And I hope you're satisfied, you rascal, you.
Yeah, I'll be fine. Just stop singing that song.
And that was Tony Bennett and Lady Gaga. Did you enjoy that?
I like that very much.
Jaunty.
Didn't he? Because he did, I believe, an album with KD Lang once as well.
Yeah, he did. He's good. Well, I mean, anyone would want a duet with Tony Bennett because he kind of makes it, he gives it that kind of, he gives it gravitas. And he's 80. He's in his 80s. It's pretty amazing.
And still has a good voice.
Yeah, he really does. What do we got next? Coming up next, we've got Deo Olopade talking about how to make Africa vibrant.
Monaco has shops around the world selling our exclusive collaborations with some of our favourite designers, including Ettinger, Porter, Barenna, Jawbone, Oliver Peoples, and many more. You can find us on College Street in Toronto, Hudson and Charles in New York, and in the heart of Wan Chai in Hong Kong, and two in London. So, whether you're after a versatile travelling wardrobe, something for the home or a present for a loved one, or just missing back issues from your collection, you're sure to find something at the Monaco shop.
Now, the image the media gives us of Africa tends to be, well, a little bit gloomy. The dominant features are about endless poverty and misery. And recently, it's been impossible to miss the stories on the spread of Ebola and the unrest in many corners of the continent.
However, there is another bright side to the vast place, the one that is about booming commercial opportunities, technological innovations, and continuing improvement for families and the environment. That's what our next guest has been writing about, and she argues that in many ways, Africa's model of doing more with less could be a very useful model for the rest of the world. Deo Olopade, author of The Bright Continent, Breaking Rules and Making Change in Modern Africa, joins us now. I read out the whole title of the book.
Thank you for that.
Almost stumbled
the
over it.
The subtitle is well considered.
Dio, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
First of all, we're all writers, journalists, broadcasters sitting around this table here in this radio studio. Is this a big problem with the media itself, how we present Africa? I know that's part of your book, but is that kind of what we're talking about?
Yes, narratives matter. Narratives drive outcomes. You know, that's something I learned as a reporter in Washington, and it's as equally relevant to an area that I know well, which is sub-Saharan Africa. You know, I'm a diaspora American with Nigerian descent, and I did find that the continent I knew well from a personal level as an African was not represented in the profession in which I was practicing as an American. And so the instinct was to intervene, to try, because outcomes are driven by narrative, to tell a better story about Africa, to tell one that would attract the investor class, to tell one that would attract technologists, folks who are interested in public health innovation, folks interested in off-grid energy. And if you're in any of these communities, or even if you're just a curious bystander, I think my book provides some new narrative and more detail and sophistication to a narrative that, as you have mentioned, had been quite one-dimensional.
Yeah, you get bogged down. It's a whole thing. Every time you open your newspaper, Africa's good for one thing, which is kind of, you know, sad stories.
Right.
You never hear about the culture, you hear about it in a rather kind of, you know, nanny-ish way. That's a big problem, I always
Yes,
think.
I think ordinary life in Africa is very mystified to many people.
Yeah.
Even if you're sophisticated and a progressive, you haven't spent a lot of time in the continent, you don't really have a good imagination for what it's like to try and put your kids through school or commute to work. And so much of what I've written is about just explaining how people travel and explaining, you know, the very ordinary things rather than the extraordinary entrepreneur or the extraordinary civil conflicts, just the day-to-day life and the ingredients of what makes that so exciting for Africa's growth trajectory.
But I think what's interesting about your book is, you know, of course, we read some positive stories about business and trade. As you say, they tend to be about one or two exceptional people who run, you know, telecoms companies or airlines. But what your book is saying is actually a kind of very regular level. Many African people are coming up with solutions to, you know, how to run their economy. This idea we hinted at the beginning of the introduction about doing more with less. Mm-hmm. That are actually quite important lessons that should be exported as well, that we should be learning from Africa.
Yes, I'd like to challenge the entire global community to reimagine Africa's challenges as opportunities to innovate. It isn't to say that I'm Pollyannish about the problems, but that so often the reporting stops there. And I continue on to report the solutions to those problems. And very frequently, they are solutions that do more with less. They are things that support consumption when there is resource scarcity. For example, in North America, we use 40 gallons of water a day for cooking, washing, so on and so forth. In sub-Saharan Africa, it's 2 liters a day, perhaps even less. If you look about the food that's wasted, if you look about the electricity that's distributed, it really is a matter of overconsumption. And in the book, I use the terms fat economies and lean economies because I don't like the term developing country, because developing country is very normative. It suggests that you begin in the Stone Age and you progress toward Las Vegas, and that is how it ought to be.
You've been to my house. And that's the thing. There's an interesting thing in the book about private school. Like, one of these things is private schools, yeah. what we can learn.
Yeah.
And a surprisingly high amount of families, of parents send their kids to private school. Mm. Talk us through that thing, because that's one of those things that I guess is a problem that lots of people, lots of our listeners might be thinking of as well. And this right. is something that might not be normal for them to know this sort of stuff.
Right. Well, African states are dysfunctional. And so private solutions are compelling for a huge variety of people. I call it exit. People exit the public system, whether it's the they buy a generator for their own electricity. They use private healthcare, which is half the healthcare spend in Africa. They will figure out a way to send their kids to private school. And in the past, these exits have been unequally distributed. They've been available to the very wealthy who can buy their way out of the dysfunctional public sector. But the kind of innovations I'm talking about have allowed these exits to become more democratic. People can afford to send their kids to these low-cost, innovative private schools that leverage technology and other kinds of pedagogical innovations to teach many hundreds of thousands of kids at a very low cost. And so the ability to leave the public system is now affordable for so many kids. And I think it's really, again, this idea of innovating in a situation of constraint. Because in the United States, for one example, and perhaps also in the UK, it's very difficult to get a lot of changes in something like the education system because everyone's got all these habits and there's all this inertia. Whereas in a situation where the alternative is, you know, so terrible, people really do take swings, you know, for the fences.
Now, tell me, Africa has an issue, maybe, or a positive fact that many of its people are very, very young. It has, when you compare it to the Asian communities, you know, in Europe and in the Americas, it has this massive number of people under the age of 30. Now, is that an attribute for the continent, or is that something that needs to be managed better? Because we see, you know, one of the negative stories that is fairly covered, I think, is that the huge pressure of migration. You know, the people, as you say, whether that's informal migration or actually getting visas and going places, many people see the opportunities for themselves outside of the continent. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you think can be reversed if we begin to find, or if Africans begin to find solutions to, you know, give those people employment, give those people more opportunities back in their home nations?
I think youth unemployment globally is at the worst it's been since we've been measuring those statistics. And it's a huge problem in sub-Saharan Africa where the population is so young. There's a sociologist from Mozambique that I reference in my book who talks about waithood, which is the space between childhood and adulthood, where you're not reaching social adulthood, where in the past you might have been 22 years old, you would maybe be married, you might be in stable employment, you might even have a child. Whereas today, that same individual is stuck in a kind of purgatory where the economy doesn't have opportunities for them, and so they cannot assume the responsibilities of adulthood and progress in their life. And I think it's, on the one hand, dangerous. I think so much of the instability and disaffection and in some cases open violence that you've seen from groups like Al-Shabaab, from groups like Boko Haram, Al-Qaeda and Islamic Maghreb, blossom in this sort of vacuum left by an empty economy that can't provide for young men in particular. And on the other hand, it's completely correctable. We talk so much about GDP growth in sub-Saharan Africa, but as many economies know, you can have jobless growth. And so finding opportunities for those people locally is, as you point out, essential for making sure that Africans are developing Africa and rather than migrating elsewhere.
Yeah, because that's the thing, isn't it? Because you've talked about all these things that we can learn. I mean, maybe foreign governments can learn from the way that small-time business works maybe in Africa, or just the family unit maybe works in certain ways. What about when big companies go, wow, this is great, they only use 2 litres of water a day and we use 500 litres of water a day. Mm-hmm. Is that the problem, that the sellers of this potential technology or this way of doing business, they need to be Africans rather than Western or Asian companies going in and taking the stuff out, right?
Yes, your point is well taken. I think
Thank you.
Local ownership is essential.
Yeah.
And I think so much of the history of Africa has been about external actors showing up, exploiting resources, and then disappearing. And I actually find that in my experience reporting, there have been so many local people who are better positioned to see the lowest hanging fruit. It doesn't require reinventing the wheel. It requires merely recognizing a pain point and filling it, right? Mohamed Ibrahim made money in telecoms. He's, the UK Sudanese billionaire. Likewise, one of my favorite stories is an aluminum can factory in Nigeria. Now, it seems sort of banal to have an aluminum can factory, but when you consider the fact that most of the cans that are used in sub-Saharan Africa are steel and come from South Africa, the idea that you could build an aluminum can factory in Nigeria that employs about 2,000 people and is now the source for the kind of beverages that the new middle class consumer class wants to drink, you start to see the transformative potential of just paying attention to these small things and taking risks maybe in a way that Western or Asian investors may not. And that's the advantage of African business people.
Yeah. Using your book as a lens, let's put it on a country then you know very well, Nigeria. So when we see reporting here, we see, on the tough side, we see the stories about the likes of Boko Haram. On the positive side, we see the stories about Nollywood and about the cultural renaissance that continues apace in Nigeria. But in between those two pillars, when you look at Nigeria as somebody who knows it well, and when you see what's told about the country outside, what do you think is missing from that story?
Nigeria is an incredibly resilient, incredibly entrepreneurial place. When you understand the reality that electricity in Lagos and throughout Nigeria is so inconstant, it goes out at least once a day, maybe even twice a day. And then you consider that Nigeria has the highest GDP growth rates in sub-Saharan Africa, the largest population, the most commercial opportunities. It's a miracle anything happens at all. You know, there are so many obstacles, so many that litter the path for an entrepreneur, for someone trying to educate their kids, for someone trying to get a job, that the fact that Nigeria is, showing up and performing so well is really remarkable to me. I think what's also notable about Nigeria is its diaspora. I mean, I'm a member of that community. And you're seeing in the last decade, with accelerating pace in the last 5 years, folks like myself moving back to Nigeria with skills they've acquired elsewhere, with a mindset and mentality to change Nigeria, most often in the private sector, increasingly in the public sector. And that gives me the most hope for the kind of reforms that the country needs and the continent broadly could desperately use.
And just finally, your book's a book. Mm-hmm. It's got its niche. It's got its shelf, literally. How do you get the stories in that book to become news items, to become features, to become stuff that is people's leitmotif of a country and of a continent rather than specialist knowledge?
I think so many of the stories in the book are immediately recognizable, and those that aren't are fascinating and they're interesting. I remember when I was working on the book, my editor, I was explaining to her how everything is negotiable. I was like, oh yeah, you negotiate for taxi and then you negotiate for this and then you negotiate for my bed, which had been made bespoke by a carpenter in an informal sector cluster in Kenya. And she was like, wait, slow down. Everything's negotiable? And I said, yeah. I mean, isn't that normal? She was like, that's really incredible. You have to explain what that is. You have to explain a little more what it's like to be in a situation like that. And so the more I've written the book and talked about it, I've realized there are things that are completely universal and things that are completely surprising. And so I think it's that balance between the two of them, where there are experiences that people can reflect on and understand intuitively, and also things that seem, breathtaking and utterly fresh, that should make the substance of the book continue to be a topic of discussion well beyond the publication.
Okay, the book is The Bright Continent, Breaking Rules and Making Change in Modern Africa. The author is Deo Olopade. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
There's a new sound coming to Monocle 24.
This is Nick Luskin. Join me for new music from around the world, Wednesday, 1500 London time. We'll be bringing live sessions and interviews to the mix every week, and all kinds of wonderful artists and records that you might not know yet, but you're sure to love.
That's brand new music from around the world. Monocle presents Nick Luscombe every Wednesday, 1500 hours London time.
Thanks to climate change, there have been new and interesting wine regions appearing around the world. At the same time, there's an increased interest in local production, which is bringing winemaking into new areas, including central London.
Indeed, after years of a craft beer boom in the British capital, it's finally wine's turn. The first vino to be produced in central London has now hit the shelves. London Crew is the name of the company making the stuff, and the general manager, Adam Green, joins us now, and he comes in with a clinking, clanking bag of what, Adam?
Of three of our 2013 wines, the very first vintage that we've produced. Uh-huh. So probably best to give you a little bit of the background, first of all, because why on earth London, and how on earth are we doing it, I suppose, are the two fairest questions.
Do you need us here? You can ask yourselves.
Yeah,
I was going
to say. You ask the questions. You can do the questions and the answers. We'll just drink the stuff, Andrew, and then at the end, after about 12 minutes, that's it. It's perfect.
We've had to explain this quite a few times to quite a few people, so we're pretty good with it. The project actually came about from a conversation between myself and our winemaker, Gavin Monnery, who's from Western Australia originally, and was really used to working with grapes which had been shipped maybe 8 or 10 hours cross-country in the middle of the heat, in the middle of the day there. And we were both committed to being in London for our own domestic reasons, and he wanted to get back into winemaking. So we started to stick a pin in a map and say, well, how far can you get grapes within 8-10 hours from London? And we got down to about the middle of France. And then we spoke to a project in New York, a place in Manhattan called City Wine, who were doing a similar venture. And when we talked to them, we said, well, look, you're working with fruit from upstate New York. That's not too far. It's a reasonable drive. But also they were taking grapes from California and bringing them back to the East Coast. So we said, how on earth are you doing this? And they were cold shipping in a truck cross country. Said 5 days, no problem whatsoever. At which point we went back to the map, stuck the pin in again and said 5 days. And that was pretty much all of Europe open at that point. So that was really where the idea came from. We were very lucky that we had some strong support and some strong backers who saw an opportunity here and decided to stick some money in and start a winery up in the centre of town.
So tell us, literally during production, you've got trucks coming in from across Europe full, just with grapes, boxes of grapes.
Yep. We go out to the vineyards, supervise the grapes being picked. They go into the back of a refrigerated, articulated truck like you'd see for shipping anything else, and it drives straight from there back to the winery as fast as possible. So in the next 2 weeks, we will probably be having 20 tonnes of grapes arriving into Earl's Court.
And why traditionally hasn't that been done before? Because you'd imagine that, you know, in the past, Victorians would have thought, all right, we can make our own London wine. But why has it not happened before?
A lot has always been shipped in bulk to the UK and then bottled here. You know, particularly if you think of companies like Harvey's down in Bristol. Mm. They started out as a shipper who bottled in the UK. I think one of the big challenges for us was ensuring the quality of the grapes. So, for example, everything we work with is hand-harvested, which means we hire a team of pickers rather than going through with a mechanical picker, which is a giant tractor, which just knocks all the grapes off the vines. So there's an additional expense there. We take a dedicated vehicle to ship it back. So it's quite a lot of work to ensure that the grapes arrive back in perfect condition, but that's our primary concern. And actually the key moment in the whole thing in 2013, sort of doing this for the first time, was opening up the back of the first truck that arrived, lifting off the first pallet of grapes, taking a look at a bunch and asking Gav how they looked. And he said, well, they look exactly like they did when they left the vineyard, which was both brilliant because it meant we could actually make this thing work, and terrifying because if it went horrifically wrong from that point, it was going to be squarely on our shoulders.
You couldn't blame the grapes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There are examples, actually. I mean, there are stories of sort of Italian communities in various parts of London always shipping grapes over from Italy every year and then making wine at home for their own consumption. I just don't think it's been done commercially before.
And tell me, you, that often when winemakers, the reason they make stuff in the countryside is because, you know, it's cheap to have places to store the caskets and the bottles as it matures. Have you deliberately chosen, therefore, wines that are best sold fresh?
Absolutely. It's not the most economical place to do it in terms of cost per square foot to be doing this in London. But what we really wanted to do, looking at it from a completely different angle, was when you mentioned craft beer and craft distilling in the introduction, both of those sectors have done a fantastic job at engaging people with the products that they make and why an artisanal product is so much more exciting than an industrial one. And wine has really lagged behind in the UK on this. I mean, the average price spent on a bottle of wine here is still just over £5, and 80% of it's sold in the supermarkets. And what we really wanted to be was part of the counter-argument to that by bringing the process closer to people and being able to say, no, look, this is the time and effort that has to go into making a good bottle of wine, trying to encourage people to trade up a little bit more. So that was the reason for really choosing to locate here. In terms of the varieties to work with and the kind of wines we wanted to make, we had two rules in the first year. One was we wanted to make great varieties people had heard of. We thought it was a pretty big ask to say to people, hey, we're London's first winery, come and buy London's first Zina Mavro or Nera Mascarolese or, you know, some other crazy variety that people haven't come across that much.
No, sorry, I don't need my plumbing fixed.
Yeah. And the second one was to make wines which hopefully, as we'll see now, once bottled, we're going to be pretty good straight off the bat. Because again, we didn't think it was fair to be saying, we've made this fantastic wine, stick it in your cellar for 5 years, because it's not going to be ready till then.
But I think it's time to pop a cork.
Well, yeah, while you're uncorking them, Adam, maybe you could tell us, you were talking about kind of how to engage people. Obviously, the branding is very interesting. When you brought the bottles in, I complimented you on the look of the label and stuff. That's presumably a big deal for you guys as well.
Yeah, we wanted to make sure that all the way along, we had kind of a sort of a fresh and modern approach to how we did things. And actually, we've been quite restricted by what we can and can't put on the bottles anyway. So we're, at present, we're unable to put the vintage or the variety onto the wines. So we've had to be quite smart in trying to direct people towards that information, use of QR codes, a lot of information on the website, etc.
This is, I think you were explaining before the show, there's some kind of weird British interpretation of some EU rule.
Yep.
So when people see the bottle in a nice wine shop, yes, they don't know what's in it.
We've got materials there for everyone who's going to be stocking it, so they can be.
So there's
it can
a
be given out
by the.
Yeah, we just can't put it actually physically on the
That's
bottle.
That's so weird.
Is that because you've produced it in London? You're not allowed to therefore name or reference a region, for example.
Producing it in London, we were always going to lose the right to the appellation. So actually,
That's delicious.
We've got a Chardonnay now,
yeah,
which
is
this would have been a Van de Pay wine if it had been made in
really?
France. Yeah, which is a fairly low tier for the wine. So the grapes are from down in Roussillon. The Syrah, which I'll pop out next, actually would have been an Appellation wine if it had been made locally. It would have been Côte de Roussillon Village, I think. And the Barbera that we made would have been Barbera d'Alba, because it comes from that specific area.
Good, hearty stuff.
Yeah, we knew we'd always lose that, but what we'd hoped we'd be able to retain through a sensible interpretation of the laws was being able to say what the grapes were, because we've been really transparent about everything else in the process.
Yeah. So there's an interesting challenge for you there, though, to how to make SW6, which is what it says on the label. Is this what it says on the label?
Yes, I guess
that's what Earl's Court, that's what they're all called.
It was the closest we could get to anything geographical.
Yeah, right. Okay. And I guess there's a challenge for you, before we talk about wine, maybe, Andrew, to get people to put those two things together in their head, as the you guys and what the varietals are.
Yeah, I mean, what we're trying to do in terms of where the wines are going to be found, they're either in Robeson App, our sister company's shop, or we're working with quite a few restaurants and bars, so places like Sager and Wild and Mission over in Hackney, Palomar just down in Soho. Mm. And we're doing a lot of training with the guys from those places to make sure they're completely up to speed with what we're trying to do.
Yeah, that's important for you to get brand recognition.
It's great on two levels. One, I mean, these guys are very serious operations, and therefore they wouldn't take something they felt was gimmicky or substandard. But two, it's great to have those people actually pulling corks for customers and advocating for the wine.
And also, this thing sits on your table for an hour at lunchtime or something. That's a good way of making friends with the brand, isn't it, presumably?
Yes, I mean, it's nice and tactile. Yeah. Nice and right. That's a good thing about
wine. And what was your route into being a winemaker then?
I've got no technical winemaking background. I've been in the wine industry for about 10 years now, but like a lot of people in this trade, it was serendipitous. Largely, it came out of a conversation with my brother, who's a chef, where we talked about having a venture together, and he did rightly point out at one juncture that I should probably go off and get some relevant skills, because he felt I wasn't bringing much to the equation at that point. So
like my relationship, Andrew, with it. I think that is absolutely delicious wine. It's really nice that it's not too cold.
So are these the official wine labels now we have?
Yeah,
the
these are absolutely the finished products.
I love this one, which is just the postcode South SW6 picked out in the middle of the...
That was the look for all of them, because we wanted to just try and have some sense of place, because it's so important with wines.
Okay, so we've had the Chardonnay. That's lovely.
I think maybe if we go on and do the Syrah, which is from the same family, same vineyards.
This is good.
It's always wise to mix your reds and whites, I think, in quick succession.
Well, that's what I've always been told.
Okay, this is very, very almost pinky red.
It's quite pale, yeah. I mean, Gav, actually, growing up in Australia, you'd associate it pretty heavily with Shiraz. Mm. But he's from Western Australia, which is much more Cabernet country. And his best experience of working with this variety actually came in France. He worked for a guy called Jean-Louis Scharf, which, if you want to muck around with Syrah, is about as good as it gets for wine geeks. I mean, it's pretty much the top of the tree. So it's a lighter, more delicate style. Again, we wanted something that was going to be good as soon as the cork was popped.
It's delicious. That could almost be like a summery wine.
Yeah. You can even chill it slightly. You just take the edge off. And
it's really
nice, refreshing. And in all the wines we made, we wanted to keep them bright, refreshing. Not too heavy, not too ripe, not too oaky. That's not our thing at all.
And is there a limitation on doing, a London wine? Does that mean that, you're not going to be able to ship it even to, like, Manchester, or certainly not back to Paris.
No,
or,
we've had some interest internationally already, and nationally. We're out at a few places outside of London. We've got someone in Canada who's looking to take the wines on. Had some interest from a project we do in Sweden as well, and we're looking at Hong Kong at the minute.
I was going to say, get to China. That's the thing.
So I think there's, I think actually, both in terms of the markets we could sell to and in terms of the wines we could make, one of the great things about this is you're almost boundaryless, you know. Yeah. This year we're going to make a different lineup of wines to the ones we made last year, and next year will be the same. And hopefully as we move along, we can take people with us and become a little bit more experimental in what we do as well. So this is the Cabernet Sauvignon, which is from just outside of Béziers in the Languedoc. And this has been the one which actually I think we've probably had the strongest reception for so far in the press.
So we're a little bit in inkier territory here, aren't we?
Yes, yeah. You'll find it a sort of richer, fuller style.
You liking that, Andrew?
I'm very impressed that you gargled with water, clean your palate first. I'm just knocking it back.
Oh, yeah, that's much tanniny kind of inkier thing.
Actually, you know, if we were having a conversation with the certifying bodies about putting the variety on the label, this is the one I'd like to put in front of them, because I'd love somebody to tell me that's not Cabernet Sauvignon. It is absolutely what it says it is.
And that's absolutely fantastic. And how you talk about tours and stuff of the winery, how sexy have you had to make that to get people in there? Do you know what I mean? Or is it quite, you want it to be quite working?
Gavin gave us very strict instructions that he was having nothing beyond a working winery. There's no sort of a too much additional things on top of that. No, it's very much a functional industrial space. The building we're in is it's a former gin distillery anyway, so it's a good setup for producing drinks in anyhow. And I think, you know, there's plenty of polished stainless steel for people to be going in and
That's good, works for us.
Room full of barrels, which always...
And just tell us, you said that people are a bit cheap in London about their wines. What are you trying to get out of their pocket?
These are all £15 per bottle. But, the price I gave is actually the national average. I mean, we're used to working in the independent retail sector, and we find that, you know, personally speaking, for me, the sweet spot for best value for wines now lies between sort of 10 and 25 quid. So we want to be banging that.
Can you get it in the sampler in Islington?
You can't. You can get it in Robeson and Kensington. That's the only retailer present.
No, I'm just saying, because that's...
That's your local.
The local, definitely. Yeah.
They know you in there, do they, Rob?
No.
They also know you at the bottle recycling plant as well, don't they?
Let's move on. Andrew, well,
thank you very much indeed.
Also, we should also presume that people can access this online. Yep. Where should they go?
www.londoncrew.co.uk.
Londoncrew.co.uk.
Delivery within a couple of days if they want to place an order.
My favourite crew with a W. Adam, thank you so much in being decent with the measures.
And here's and cheers to you.
Chin chin.
Thank you.
All right, and that was edition 272 of the Monocle Weekly.
Now, a couple of weeks ago, we said we should add some alcohol to the show. We had gin last week, wine this week.
People are getting now right in and going, now there's too much booze.
No, no, no.
You sound too happy at the end of the show.
It's been enjoyable, actually. Do you know what I like about having like a food or drink thing on is the passion of these people who come in. And what's amazing is that there is a real shift in the way that food and drink is done, and the idea of localism and all these things that seem a bit kind of removed sometimes, or a bit kind of like worthy. But when, you know, someone like Adam comes in and just starts talking about why he's making wine in London, it's really exciting. It's cool.
Because it's not an easy thing to do. Like, it's not an easy thing to write a book either. But no. I mean, it's, you know, a lot of these people have given up a job to do it. It's not like they were born into it. None of the people we have in have inherited their thing from someone. They've kind of quit something to do it. And I kind of like that.
He's just doing a good thing at his own beat.
He's definitely doing a good thing with that Syrah. Can't get enough of that. Can feel...
There's going to be a wine bottle scrap after this.
Exactly. Clanking at high noon. Let's thank our friends behind the glass. Not that glass.
Mr. Marcus Hippie was behind the glass.
Mr. Marcus
in every sense.
Behind the smoked glass as well. There he is. Today's show is produced by Marcus Hippie, and our studio manager was Claire Urban. We should maybe save them something. Maybe the cabinet something.
Yes, well, there's a little bit left.
And we'll be here. Will we be here same time next week? I think we will be.
I think
you're going to be back in time from Istanbul. For the time being, then, from me, Robert Bound.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.